I am Planta on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. One of the more striking and moving films is Metamorphosis, the new documentary by the filmmakers Velcro Ripper and Nova Ami. It will be having a theatrical run here in Vancouver at the Van City Theatre the 26th through the 20th of June. Throughout June, there will be dates in Montreal, Toronto, Calgary, Edmonton, and Victoria. It's visually stunning. It realistically shows us the scale of the crisis we face with climate change and environmental calamities. But beyond that, we see where in the world there is hope. The marvelous lesson is that in a time of change, there is hope in the period of transition. I'm joined by Ms. Amy and Mr. Ripper, and I'll get them to tell us about their film, the places they take the viewer to around the world in Milan, Phoenix, and elsewhere. Velcro Ripper's previous films include his Fierce Light trilogy, Scared Sacred, Fierce Light, and Occupy Love, the first which won the 2005 Genie Award for Best Feature Documentary. His first feature-length film, Bones of the Forest, won Best of the Festival at Hot Docs, and the 1996 Genie for Best Feature Documentary. Nova Ami is a noted filmmaker for her socially relevant and thought-provoking films, including Say I Do, Secrets, and Piecing It Together. They have screened at international festivals, including Hot Docs and IDFA, and on sundry broadcast outlets such as the BBC, CBC, and CTV, among others. Visit metamorphosis.media for more information. This film is a National Film Board of Canada co-production. They joined me from here in Vancouver last month while in town for the Doxa Documentary Film Festival. Please welcome to the Planta on the Line program, Velcro Ripper and Nova Ami. Ms. Ami, good morning.
Good morning.
And Mr. Ripper, good morning.
Good morning. Great to be here.
Thanks for joining us. So the film is a good way for us to realize that we shouldn't lose faith, especially in the time of crisis, despite the urgent danger around us. As someone said in the film, it takes a lot of stamina for us to confront the grief of what's happening. At what point were you in your own lives, say, that you decided to make a film like this?
Well, it was about 4 years ago, actually, where we first started talking about making Metamorphosis. At the time, Typhoon Haiyan had just occurred in the Philippines, and I've spent a lot of time in the Philippines. My background is Filipino, and it really weighed heavily on me, and over 6,000 people were killed in that event. And so Velcro and I had a lot of conversations about how an event like that would change a person and how humanity is changing in the face of this crisis that we've created. And so that really got things started in terms of developing our ideas and our thoughts about the film, and you know, that really started the ball rolling.
That's the other thing that in your film, someone else says, what happens in one place of the world really does have an effect in another place of the world. And I guess we don't really, we know that, we should know that, but we don't really think about that. Mm-hmm. And you mentioned an event, you know, in Southeast Asia. These things have ramifications for us here, mm-hmm. as well as what we do in this part of the world.
Most definitely. And you know, as time went on, it actually felt like climate change was getting closer and closer to home. There is a tendency to think of climate change as something happening far away or to somebody else.
Up north or something like that.
Yeah, polar bears are going to suffer. Well, actually, those wildfires and the drought that we're experiencing, that's all related to climate change here in BC. And also all the way down the coast, we did a lot of filming in California during the massive drought there, which is not really over yet, and could continue indefinitely. And so it's something that's coming right into our own backyards.
Now, when you make a film like this, and you want to confront, I mean, these are huge issues to confront. How do you guys not get weary or get complacent or lazy even, or you know, just overwhelmed by it all, with sadness even?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that, you know, when we conceived of the film, we also conceived of a child.
Mm.
And so from the very beginning of this process of making the film, we had this constant reminder of, the fact that we were bringing a child into this world. And in a lot of ways, that was our way of remembering that to find hope in our lives. And it was our way of showing that we are hopeful. And, you know, we constantly had to ask ourselves and question, you know, what is our role here? And, you know, are we here to protect him, to prepare him? And, you know, I think that also finding a way to feel hopeful is a choice in terms of how to deal mm-hmm. with what's happening in the face of this crisis. You know, we can choose to give up or we can choose to be hopeful.
And, you know, the film really explores the emotional and the psychological implications of climate change, which a lot of films don't, actually. So that's one of the things that makes this film unique. It's also giving us tools to help us figure out how to deal with this crisis. And in fact, Nova and I are both certified coaches, life coaches, and we've developed a workshop that goes with the screenings of the film to help people deal with the emotional and psychological and even spiritual implications of dealing with this long emergency.
We don't really think of that, don't we? We think of it as, say, flooding our house mm-hmm. or making it warmer for us in the summer, warmer winters and far hotter summers. But yeah, the psychological impacts of that, I mean, that's something that I guess we're just short-sighted to, perhaps. Did you find that? I mean, in terms of the people that, when you travel the world, when you go to these places like Milan and places in the United States, is that something that's overlooked?
Well, I think that it may be something that we actually block unconsciously, mm. you know, because it's hard to deal with something that just keeps coming at us. One of the characters in the film is actually a psychiatrist and a psychohistorian, the amazing Robert J. Lifton.
Is that the guy whose apartment has these little figures and things like that?
Yes,
in the window?
That's right. Yeah. He's fantastic. He's about 93 now, and a great thinker. And he talks about something called psychic numbing, and that is a way that we kind of shut down. And in some ways, some forms of climate denial might be related to our inability to confront the scope of the crisis. So the question is, how do we keep our hearts open in the face of this crisis and find the strength to move forward? How can we actually transform our grief? And as Nikki Silvestri says in the film so brilliantly, the depths, when we actually get in touch with that grief, what does it come from? It comes from love. You know, if we lose a family member, the grief that we feel is because of the love we feel for that person. If we're losing elements of our ecology, of the planet Earth, the grief we feel, if we get in touch with it, if we don't damp down and psychic numb, is love. It comes from love. So that can actually help you to say, okay, so what do I do with that love? It could inspire you to serve and protect the Earth.
Now, how do you not allow your whatever love you're feeling to get consumed by trying to convince those that just don't, you know, who think the other way or who don't even care, say?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, you know, we're hoping that with our film that, you know, the feedback that we've received so far is that it's not a film that makes people feel judged.
Yeah.
It's non-judgmental and it's not preachy or lecturing.
That's a great word for it because I hate to admit this, but I went into the film thinking that I was going to get lectured. But I mean, that's not the coming away from it. That's not what I you know. That's not what I feel. I guess you consciously set out to do that, right?
Yes. And you know, when we were developing themes for the film, we talked about the workshop. Velcro mentioned that the themes that we explored, they're not labeled in the film, but we use them as scaffolding in terms of the arc of the film. And so we started off with chrysalis,
which is the sanctuary, the place you go to transform.
And then following that would be crisis,
which is the wake-up call.
Mm-hmm. And then following that would be catharsis,
which is the processing of the crisis and the letting go and the moving forward.
And then symbiosis,
which is the final phase of the film, and that's those stories of hope and possibility and living with what we call mutually enhancing relationships with the planet.
Yeah, and someone came up to me the other night after one of our screenings and said, you know, a lot of films are stuck in the crisis phase and they don't move beyond it. Mm-hmm. And it was really important for us that, you know, that obviously that's a part of the film, but that we want to explore how to move through that. And you know, we feel that's really important for us today to have tools to move through to the catharsis and symbiosis.
Yeah, you can get quite consumed by thinking of a crisis and just not do anything and just say, you know, to hell with it. I'm just going to hide for the rest of the day and mm-hmm. the rest of the decade, say.
Yeah.
So when you talk to people, young people especially, I mean, that's wherein the hope lies, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, we screen the film and led workshops with high school students in the past week. And, you know, they have really thoughtful questions about what we're doing and saying and really great ideas about, you know, things that they want to do. And it's exciting for us to see their energy and their enthusiasm, you know, when they feel this sense of empowerment and inspiration to try new things and come up with ways to give as opposed to receive.
How many places did you guys go to for the film? I'm trying to make a list there. It's more than five, right?
Oh, yeah. It's more like maybe 15 different places. Yeah. There was Vanuatu in the South Pacific. There was all over the States, Phoenix, Los Angeles, up and down California coast.
We went to Europe. We were in Milan and Venice. Uh-huh. And we filmed in the Canary Islands with one of the artists, Jason DeCare Taylor, and also in Munich with another artist, Ha Schult.
And in Mexico at the Butterfly Sanctuary, and also with the underwater sculptures. And those are the main locations.
Yeah.
The underwater sculptures, was that in Mexico?
Both Mexico and the Canary Islands.
I see, yeah. So when you're making a film like this, how much time do you have to, I mean, the logistics of the places to go and the time that you have and the budgets, of obviously, is that a lot of work in terms of, I mean, it's really the planning, is it, when you're making a movie?
That's a lot of it, but it's also being open to what's happening where you are. So, you know, with documentary, you can plan all you want and, you know, try to be as organized as possible and think about, you know, potential scenarios. But then when you're in the moment, you also have to be open to things that you would never expect to happen that are, you know, just the most incredible things, because you can't plan what a person is going to say or do or a situation that's going to arise, you know.
Like the fires in Lake County, we weren't expecting that. We were actually filming in Southern California, and suddenly this huge forest fire, the third largest fire in California history, happened. And so we raced across the state and went to film that fire. And
And, you know, we didn't know when we started shooting that what the climate events would be. We didn't know we'd be starting in Vanuatu.
Right.
We just sort of had this scene planned that we would shoot, but we didn't know where it was going to be and when it was going to happen. And it just happened to happen right at the beginning and in the South Pacific. So
That's where you looked at the devastation of cyclones.
That's right. Mm-hmm.
I guess in that part of the world, cyclones are the typhoons, I guess those are commonplace. But, I mean, they're coming up here, aren't they?
Well, the cyclones are commonplace, but they'd never in their history, even their oral history going way back, had a cyclone that immense.
Yeah.
And, you know, they'd never witnessed the destruction of the massive banyan trees, which...
These trees are just uprooted.
Yeah.
They're huge.
Huge trees, which are actually their traditional cyclone shelters. And to see those uprooted was heartbreaking.
It's overwhelming, it must be. I mean, breathtaking to see some of these images. But, you know, you see all the butterflies that are dead, and you see these trees uprooted.
Mm-hmm.
This devastation. How do you not let that affect you and say, you know, consume you with grief?
Well, I think, you know, we have to let it affect us.
Yeah.
You know, we have to process it. We have to feel it, because if you don't let it affect you, I mean, it's not going to go away. It's just going to be, you know, it's going to be...
Damped down.
And so...
It'll come
I
back,
think,
though, right?
You know, it's important to feel.
Yeah.
And
fully feel
to feel it and then, you know, move through it, process it, like any grief, right? Mm-hmm. Any loss, any devastation, it's really important to allow yourself to move through it, to get to the other side.
Yeah, you need to connect, and then there's almost an openness that comes after that grief, and then you can say, well, okay, now what do I do? Now how do I move forward? And that can inspire you to say, okay, so what can I do to make this world a better place?
Even in the devastation, these images, some of them are very beautiful, mm-hmm. because you can see that this is a way to start over again, mm-hmm. and build anew. And you really get that sense from the people. These are fascinating people that you get to talk to in the course of the movie. Mm-hmm. You mentioned the fires in California. Mm-hmm. I was struck by a couple of them in their accents.
Mm-hmm. Scottish accents.
Yeah. And so I wondered where they were and how they ended up there. How do you meet some of these people that you get to talk to in the film?
Well, that fire was, we actually were filming in Porterville, a scene that's not actually in the film in the end, but it's a town that has no water. And I guess that family took refuge in Porterville because they had a relative there, and it made it into the local newspaper.
Yeah.
So wherever we're shooting, we always pick up the local newspaper, those tiny little newspapers, and just read the local stories. And that's a local story that we found. Family takes shelter, and then we said, oh, this family's story sounds amazing. So we found the family back in Middleton a few weeks after the fire and went there and with them.
The other thing, other than how it looks visually, I noticed the sound of it.
Mm-hmm.
And especially in that sequence there where you're not reenacting, but when you're seeing down this road.
Oh, driving through the fire, yeah.
Yeah, the sound of a fire.
Uh-huh.
You do consider that. When you're making a movie, not just what we see, but what we hear, right?
Oh, absolutely. And in fact, Velcro was the sound designer on this film. So mm-hmm. sound is really important to us.
Yeah.
It's as important, you know, it really fills the sort of the life of what's happening. It fills in that. And so it really situates you in the scene.
Yep. Mercifully, I've never experienced fire. Mm-hmm. And so all I know about what fire, say, looks like or sounds even. Is through and what you cultivate in the movie. I mean, it's just frightening.
Yeah, and you know, when you do sound design, you have to bring in extra layers to really make it feel like it actually feels, because it's different what you can actually record and what you can actually hear. So there's also a number of sounds in multiple layers of sounds. As a sound designer, I bring in volcanoes and things like that erupting.
Breaths.
We used a lot of breath sounds with the butterfly wings. There's often a breath, male and female breaths. A lot of different sounds. I've done a lot of sound design for other feature docs over the years too, like The Corporation, other films like that. So it's one of my loves is to do sound design.
And that's part and parcel of the music as well, and picking the sort of music that you want to go along with your film.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we had a fantastic composer, James Mark Stewart, and also someone who's great at taking notes. We loved how he was able to keep tweaking and tweaking the music to get it just the way we wanted it, because Nova and I are very particular about the music, and it's got to be just right. Otherwise, it can steal a scene or dominate a scene or take away from a scene. So the music and the sound design are very integrated and very related.
Now, the other thing that I was thinking about, and someone says this in the movie, is a reason why we are where we are is the consumption that humans do, I guess is the word. I can't begin. It's early for me, pardon me. And there's a great line in the film that says, we just seem to stay alive to make payments. I'm wondering, if we consumed less, if there was less material consumption in the world, would we actually be happier? Because a lot of people think that to get happy, to get to that place of happy, we need to, you know, get as much stuff as we possibly can.
Yeah, well, we do talk in the film about slowing down and consuming less and really focusing on relationships and quality of life. And, you know, we also talk about repurposing what we already have. You know, do we really need to buy a new item, you know, this or that? Or can we make do with what we have or use one that someone else doesn't need anymore? You know, and sort of have this circle of use. Mm-hmm. So that's something that, you know, we definitely, you know, we explore in the film as a way to, you know, to question, what do we really need?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we have such a throwaway society, and we need to move towards what's called a cradle-to-cradle way of thinking, which is not cradle-to-grave, which mm-hmm. is that we use things once or twice and then we throw them away and we get something new. But something where it always stays in the system and the cycle of use. There's absolutely no reason to have such a disposable culture.
There's a house that you go to. Is it in Arizona where they use the water four times?
Oh, the airships in New Mexico.
In New Mexico, perfect. I never, you know, unfortunately, you know, I'm one of these people that never think of our consumption of water until I watched this movie, and was surprised that you could use water four times like that.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And it makes sense, you know, he says, it's Michael Reynolds who invented the Earthships. He says, why would we use drinkable water to flush a toilet?
Yeah. Yeah.
And that makes total sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so the water is used, I guess, once.
Once for
bathing.
Yeah, it goes through bathing, or drinking, bathing, watering the plants, and then flushing the toilets.
Yeah.
And then even the gray water goes into the anaerobic process, and then that's used to grow more food.
Yeah.
So it's a whole self-contained system. And we can't all live in Earthships, but many of the principles in the film, and we consider them design principles, can be integrated more and more into our everyday lives. And there's increasingly ways to do that.
So that guy Reynolds lives there?
Mm-hmm. Yes, he does.
Yeah, and are there a lot of places like that in that part of the world, say?
Well, you'll see Earthships more and more. Mm-hmm. Actually, they've been built all over the world, including Vanuatu. Last I heard, they were building one there, and there's one in the Philippines that they've built.
They seem robust, that they can withstand whatever is happening outside mm-hmm. of
yeah,
the
that's
world.
Also, you know, that's the goal with the goals of the ones in the Philippines, in Vanuatu, and also in Fiji, that they would withstand typhoons.
Yeah.
One of the great things is they go into a community, and it's a big community project to build one of these. They call them wind ships in the Philippines because they are wind resistant. But they're also built out of garbage. So they'll go out into the community and just clean up all the garbage that they can find and bring it back to the building site and use that to build the Earthship.
Yeah, it looks kind of nice, the wall with the bottoms of bottles, mm-hmm. you know, decorating the wall. And then you get the light from through the glass, right?
Yeah, it's very beautiful and creative use of our leftovers.
Yeah. Velko, of the two of you, you've been making films longer. Is that right?
Just because I'm older. We've both been doing them since we've been around the same age.
Yeah.
But I've been doing it for about 30 years.
Yeah, what struck me as I'm watching your film is not only the technology, the 4K, I guess, and the drones. You use a lot of drones in this film, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, you know, this film, I think for both of us, we wanted to up our game with this film. And somebody came up to me at the screening yesterday and said, you know, I loved your other films, but this is like the next level. And that is really what we wanted to do. Although my mom said, I love this film, but Scared Sacred is my favorite. It's like, Mom, just love the last one the best, you know. And you're not supposed to do that with your kids, but in this case, you're supposed to.
Yeah.
But, you know, we really feel like we both upped our game. And we shot in 4K. We used everything that was available. And a lot of these technologies were just coming out when we started shooting 3-4 years ago that we could get our hands on a drone that we could travel with. And that we could get 4K and travel that was suitable for documentary and not an excessively massive camera.
Yeah.
Shooting with the great prime lenses like we used to when I started off in film. So for me it was like going back to shooting in film.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Using a motorized sliders for time lapse with motion control.
Yeah, and often you don't have the opportunity to use all these when you're shooting a documentary, all these pieces of equipment because you're, you know, running after a character or something, running in a situation. And, you know, we were able to really take the time to focus on the things that we wanted to shoot, from, you know, getting the macro shots, getting really, really close shots, to, you know, going really up high and seeing, you know, things from a bird's eye view. And I think, you know, that was part of what was really exciting about our collaboration. I find that, you know, we really fed off each other's energy.
Yeah.
We really wanted to make something beautiful, and we really encouraged each other to to think big. You know, we really fed off each other's energy that way.
What's it like then to not only work together but live together? I mean, people must ask you what that's like. I mean, you're spending a lot of time with one another.
It's more than just working together and living together. It's also traveling around the world together and doing that with a baby that went from 4 months old to 3 years old in that process. So, you know, I think they say the test of a relationship is going on a trip together. So we tested it times 100 and it's still going great.
Yeah. I mean, it's not for everyone, right?
Yeah.
But it seems to work for us, especially with this project. And we plan to work together on another project. Mm-hmm. So we'll see how that goes. Yeah. Again, you know, we really feed off each other's energy and, you know, we really maximize our time in terms of being able to brainstorm and just express ourselves with what, you know, what we're thinking. If we have ideas, we just say it. It could be at the weirdest time of the day, but at least it's out there and we can kind of sit with it. You know, a lot of filmmakers who collaborate, they're not in the same space. And so it's not as fluid in terms of, you know, sharing ideas or feeding off each other. And so I think, you know, for us, it's been really helpful in terms of our creative process.
And as your son gets older, it's another member of the crew, right?
Oh, yeah. He's a production baby. He's got a credit in the film.
Yeah, definitely. And he loves to get a hold of a microphone whenever possible.
Really?
Too.
Oh, yeah. So when you look at your son, and I mean, there's the future, right? And so you obviously can't be without hope. What do you tell people then who are probably world weary at this point?
We named our son Phoenix, and in a way, that's like the image of the bird that rises from the ashes perpetually. And we've talked to many people that are world weary, including some of our friends, and also other people that recently interviewed us, and they say it's too late. There's nothing we can do. But in fact, we don't know that it's too late. We haven't hit the point of runaway climate change. No matter what we do, we're going to be in for some rough years because there's a lot of carbon already in the atmosphere. So it's going to be challenging. But you can choose hope. You can choose possibility. And you can align yourself with the forces of change. And if you were in a disaster situation, in that acute moment, would you want to be the person that did everything you could to save as many people as you could?
Or just give up, right?
Yeah. Or just give up. Our choice is to choose hope and to choose action and to choose, ultimately, to see that crisis is an opportunity for transformation.
It is a time, isn't it, Nova, where it could go either way.
Yes, but we don't know which
way.
Yeah. And, you know, even if we do take all these actions and initiatives and, you know, try to save the world, even if, say, climate change is a hoax, that some people are saying, right? It's not going to make the world a worse place doing what we're doing.
Yeah.
It's actually going to make our lives better.
Yeah. I mean, just to think, just water in its of itself. If you can use it four times, why not, right? It's an hour and 20 minutes, this film. Is that about right?
You have an hour and 25.
Yeah. So how much footage gets shot for a film like that?
Well, we shot a lot because, you know, we also use drones and you kind of just start the recording as soon as it flies up. But probably, you know, in terms of computer space, I could tell you around 4 terabytes.
Really?
Yeah. But on the other hand, a lot of the really set up shots, like the time lapses and the really elaborate shots, you don't shoot as much for those because, you know, one of the shots that I pulled off that I'm really proud of is there was a bristlecone pine with the stars moving behind it and the shadow of the moon moving over it. And that was one night of the camera going off. And then we had to go to another location. So you either get it or you don't. But then that becomes like a 30-second shot, and that's the shot. So, you know, the time lapses, there's actually very few of them because each shot takes a day to the one with the chrysalis, which Grant Baldwin, our amazing cinematographer from Vancouver, actually did. That took 2 weeks for that one shot.
He makes documentaries too, doesn't he?
Yes, he does.
He just finished a great film called This Mountain Life.
I had him on, I think, once.
Okay.
It's funny when you know, after 1,600 of these things, you forget sometimes where we are. So it was a fun experience. And how long did it take? A couple of years, say?
To make the film?
Yeah.
4 years.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. As you get to see a lot of the world. That must have been fun, too.
Well, it was never boring.
Right.
And, you know, it was really, it was a really great experience to meet people who, you know, in different parts of the world who are especially, you know, have these really great ideas that they're implementing that we can really learn from.
You go to a place where they've got these buildings and they've got gardens throughout, like on throughout. Where was that?
Oh, that's in Milan, Bosco Verticale, which means vertical forest. And it's just a stunning, spectacular image of how we could potentially rewild the urban
space.
It's
very bold architecture as well. Mm-hmm. Yeah. What other places other than Italy where you saw that? Are actually thinking of doing things like that.
Oh, in terms of the greening of buildings? You know, that was a very new initiative. They're starting to spread. I think the next Bosco Verticale will be in Switzerland. But we're starting to see a lot of this kind of greening of the urban space happening more and more. I noticed even downtown East Side, there's a building which has a bunch of trees on the roof of the condos there. And I remember there used to be the one tree in the West End, right, with the one tree on the top of the building. I always loved that building. Why isn't every rooftop a rooftop garden? And that's happening more and more. Even in New York, there's a number of rooftop gardens.
And why isn't every balcony filled with plants? And, you know?
The public library downtown, that was supposed to be green when that opened 20 years ago, and I think they're only starting to do that
now.
That's
right. Yeah, we noticed that one the other day when we walked by.
Yeah.
It's really good to see.
When you came in here today, you mentioned that you live in Brooklyn.
Well, we kind of are in Brooklyn and Toronto.
Oh, I
see. So we've been going back
commuters.
And forth. Yeah.
It's not a bad commute, I don't think.
No, an hour.
Yeah. And so what's home life for you in terms of some of the things that you learned or you picked up in the course of making this movie that sort of changed your own day-to-day life, say?
I think we're just really conscious of the disposable culture we're in and how hard it is. You almost like, you almost have to fight to not be given something that you're going to use for 1 minute and throw away. And we have to also be conscious ourselves. That's very elementary. And more cities are passing bylaws that say no more disposable bags, no more
straws.
I think straws are going out. And you know, these kinds of things, that's something where we can just say no very easily. Just say no. We have to carry around our cups with us. But, you know, that's not too hard. And avoid takeout containers and things, crazy things like that. Very simple, but it's just a constant reminder of how much we take the planet for granted.
And I guess a lot business has a lot to do with making it attractive for the consumer to not, you know, when you go to the coffee shop, for example, to bring your cup, your mug.
Yeah, or also, you know, some places, they automatically give you a straw.
Mm.
You don't even ask for it, and they just, before you can even say anything, they've put one in front of you.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, they can take the initiative with that and just not give you a straw, right?
Are you working on something new now?
We're developing a project that's about the global refugee crisis, and it's going to be a feature animation doc.
So we're going to do interviews with the subjects in audio only, which is also what we did for Metamorphosis. Mm-hmm. We didn't roll camera when we did the interviews, which is wonderful because it makes people feel much more comfortable. They're not conscious of a lens right in their face. And with refugees, it'll give them a security in that their identity might not be so revealed for people that are still afraid of, say, repercussions to family members that are
still back home
in those dangerous situations. So, and then the animation will allow us to explore a whole new realm of filmmaking, which is something neither one of us has really done much of before.
It must be fun to actually think about wanting to do that.
Mm-hmm.
Something that you've never done before, which is fascinating.
Yeah, that's what we did with Metamorphosis, and that's what we want to keep doing moving forward.
Well, this is a hell of a good film. I enjoyed watching it a great deal. It's as I said in the introduction, just visually stunning and a lot to think about. So congratulations on it and continued good luck with it.
Thank you so much.
Thanks so much for having us.
You're very welcome. Visit metamorphosis.media for more information. Metamorphosis will be at the Van City Theater this week, starting Tuesday, the 26th of June. As well, throughout the country, check the National Film Board's website at nfb.ca for more information. Nova, Emmy, and Velcro Ripper joined me in person from here in Vancouver this past May. I'm Joseph Planta.